Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, your listener-supported community radio station. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I'll be your host for our show. Gun violence, the January 6 hearings, and impending climate catastrophe are among the top issues that capture headlines these days. We're going to take a look at all three from a left perspective this morning. Our well-read Red, Bill Resnick, comments on actions that could actually reduce gun violence, according to global health consultant and writer Cesar Shalala. In their Left and the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker will explore the implications of the January 6 hearings, and Bill Resnick returns at the end of the show with commentary about a recent inside, high-level critique of the climate policy being pursued by the U.S. Marines. We're going to lead off our show, however, with a discussion about issues that rarely, if ever, get featured in the headlines, issues of land and language in Indian country. Nimipu Nez Perce, an old mole, Julian Ankney, speaks with Kellen Ternow, Nimipu and Black visual artist, performer, and podcast host, about land acknowledgement, language reclamation and revitalization, connections between language and land, and the Land Back Movement. Before we get rolling, I would like to announce to our loyal listeners that the Old Mole has formed a new partnership with the hosts of two other radio shows to bring you even more great programming from a left perspective. Against the Grain airs regularly on KPFA Berkeley and is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Beneath the Surface airs weekly on KPFK Los Angeles and is hosted by Susie Weissman. Both programs feature interviews with in-depth analysis and commentary on a variety of political, economic, social, and cultural matters important to radical thinking and activism. From time to time, we will rebroadcast hour-long programs from either show on the Old Mole that we believe will be of special interest to our listeners. Tune in for our first rebroadcast next Monday morning, July 18, with a discussion from Against the Grain of our post-capitalist future. What could or should getting beyond capitalism look like? Now here's Julian Ankney with her guest, Kellen Ternow.
Tots lahain oiklo inamunik tuas, Julian Ankney. Good day, everyone. My name is Julian Ankney, and I reside on the Nez Perce Indian Reservation in Idaho. My ancestors are Lean Elk and Pile of Clouds. I am Nimipu. Translated means we the people or the real people. I am a descendant from both colonizer and colonize. Tots lahain oiklo again. Good day, everyone. Kia eitsnin was. Ask papain kina. We are happy that you are all here today. Ketsiao yao. Thank you. I'm going to be speaking about how the 4th of July celebrations have impacted ceremony, past and present. The American Indian Religious Freedom Act is a United States federal law enacted by joint resolution of the Congress in 1978. Prior to the act, many aspects of Native American religions and sacred ceremonies have been prohibited by law. That means we could not practice our own cultural ceremonies, dance, speak our language, or sing and drum. The American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978 protects the rights of Native Americans to exercise their traditional religions by ensuring access to sites, land, use, and possession of sacred objects, and the freedom to worship through ceremonies and traditional rites. Prior to the Native American Religious Freedom Act of 1978, the 4th of July was the only holiday when indigenous peoples could practice and perform our ceremonies under the guise of the 4th celebrations. Although the 4th is a national celebration for us, it is just one facet of a settler colonial nationhood. With the criminalization of Native religions, memory, sacred rituals, and objects being taken away, put in museums, and sold to private collectors. The land of the free dovetails this performative aspect of the fourth, as well as land acknowledgments, as a settler colonial ritual. I would like to read a land acknowledgement in the form of a poem by C. Mary Furman. A poem to acknowledge that the land itself, along with the people whose language, culture, and religion were born of it, is rarely acknowledged. Let us pause for a moment and acknowledge the land on which we live. This is the traditional land of the Chinookan, the Taitapam peoples, and the Cowlitz Indian tribe. We should take another moment to acknowledge the ways Indigenous people have been and are being removed and erased from the land they've stewarded for over 16,000 years. Swiftly, brutally, culturally, fatally. Let us acknowledge that soldiers for the United States killed women and children because they were Native. Let us acknowledge the recentness of this. Let us acknowledge that Native people buried in their land without markers while unnamed settlers rest in fenced graves. Let us acknowledge Indian graves dug up and looted. Let us acknowledge that place names like Custer National Forest, Squaw Meadows, and Dead Indian do not honor ancestors. Let us take a moment and acknowledge that this land was not stolen from people whose language, culture, and religion were born of it. Let us acknowledge that the people were stolen from this land. The people who celebrate this land with song, dance, ceremony, people do not commodify and commercialize trees and water or call it resource. Here we pause to acknowledge that the land itself is rarely acknowledged. The land buried beneath asphalt, cement, floorboards, and foundations. Let us acknowledge that these buried lands, which once grew food and medicine, now grow dollar stores, subdivisions, and universities. Let us acknowledge the land in the way subdividers do, with the blade of the bulldozer and with names like Forest Trails, Aspen Ridge, River Ranch, with words the way the government recognizes only federally recognized Indian tribes and has taught some natives to recognize others only on paper through blood quantum and CIB instead of commitment to rights and sovereignty. Let us recognize land acknowledgments that serve as consolation, another box checked on a list titled Due Diligence. The way wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt acknowledges white wokeness, while the same white shop at White Lives Businesses acknowledgement as performative allyship. Let us acknowledge that internment camps were prisons. This land acknowledgement was written for the people who acknowledge land in the way spotted knapweed acknowledges it, the way a for sale sign acknowledges it, the way the Forest Service acknowledges land by saying hashtag it's all yours, but meaning hashtag it's not theirs. The statement acknowledges the land in the same way the media and FBI acknowledges the over 5,000 missing women and girls by recognizing the one missing white woman for which hundreds search and whose picture is present on all our screens. The way Native silhouettes are screened on paper to sell cigarettes. This land acknowledgement is linked to the heartwood of a pine that escaped the fires but fell to the mill from a land that cannot help but acknowledge climate crisis and carrying capacities. The grizzly bear fatally removed and the salmon who can no longer reach their original homelands. This land acknowledgement acknowledges the wolves shot by the stockmen and sportsmen to preserve the animals. Stockmen and sportsmen will thenceforth kill in the name of husbandry and sport. Let us acknowledge how we honor loss with dollars and not grief. Let us make depredation a science and pay officers from the Bank of Conservation. Let us acknowledge the words used to dissociate, kill, killer, killing, killed, from the act of execution. This land acknowledges that it is recognized for its monetary value, recreational value, and aesthetic value, because it too is living. This land recognizes us by our carbon footprint, our clear cuts, our gold mines, and our greed. This land, that land back means language back, means medicine back, means ceremony back, means culture back, means reparations, means all people depend on land. Let us acknowledge that unless action is taken to identify and empower Indigenous people, erase inaccurate histories from every school curriculum, carry out land-based justice and climate change policy, a land acknowledgement is a perfunctory, alienating, and otherwise hollow gesture. Acknowledgement means acceptance, admittance. Acknowledgement is a dead word. It is not a verb. It is not deed. Does not mean education. Acknowledgement means too late for an apology. Read me your declaration of change. Detail your plan of procedure. Show me your map to equity. And then, just maybe then, I might be convinced that your land acknowledgement is not but another broken treaty. Katsiaoyao Oikolo, thank you everyone. Tots Lahain Oikolo, good day everyone. Nimi Pumul, Julian Ankney here, coming to you straight from the Nez Perce Rez in Lapwa, Idaho. We want to give a big war whoop. Oh! Welcome today to Kellen Trinow. Trinow is a visual artist, performer, small business owner, holistic wellness practitioner, alumnus of the University of Notre Dame, and his debuting work can be found in the Native Arts and Cultures Foundation 2022 archives. He was born and raised in the Pacific Northwest. Trinow's work encompasses Black and Indigenous freedoms in connection to self-autonomy, creation of contemporary sacred objects, some of which are used in Nimiipuu ceremonies and rites of passage, and memorials to our Nimiipuu warriors who fought against the U.S. cavalry, as well as connections to traditional land rights through his art. One piece in particular, a parchment bag engaging the land back movement in our homelands at the Giuseppe Center in Oregon, which is now outside of our current reservation boundaries, but will always continue to be one of our sacred places and part of our Nimiipuu homelands, past, present, and future.
Well, thank you for such an awesome welcome. That's a beautiful way to hop into the conversation.
Nimiipuu, the people, or Nez Perce, philosophies and knowledges, beliefs, customs, traditions, and visions for the future are central to the understanding the lived realities of the people, right? And illustrates the differences, but also adaptability through storytelling as theory that promotes action as change. Can you tell us how your language revitalization work aids in the preservation of cultural traditions and practices of Nimiipuu people?
Which is everything. Much is embedded in our languages. It's not only strings of words put together in order to communicate thoughts, wants, or desires. You know, there's so much more that is found within our language, how it communicates more than what is happening on the outside world. It's sharing what's happening internally or in connection with the land or in connection with the season, in connection with each other.
I know you have just been doing so much as I've been following you on Instagram and Facebook. And I'm just like, oh, I know this guy. And how has your work brought culture into a more contemporary space? And what impacts does that have?
It's an unavoidable part of my walk that I am both Black American and a Nimi Poo person. You know, I carry these two very distinct cultures, and they're different yet very oftentimes parallel histories. And so it plays into every part of my self-expression in my artwork. This person spoke about quantum theory, saying that what they enjoyed about the show that Michaela and I put together is that it spoke or created a space for community rather than speaking about community. And I loved that way of putting it because in sharing my artwork, quantum theory in itself is a art piece for both Michaela and I. And so the other forms of art that I also share through my performance art as an actor and dancer, and my visual art as a beadwork artist.
Not any beadwork artist, though. I've heard numerous people call you a master beadworker, and I have to agree with them.
What?
Just one thing that I love about your work, so there's so many different things that I love about it, of course, but I love how your work literally brings the past into the present, and then it also reestablishes or establishes that hope for the future. So, Katsi Yao Yao Trinel, you're amazing. Your work is amazing. And if anybody wants to check out Trinel's work, you can find it at trinaloriginal.com. That is T-R-E-N-A-L original.com. The nativeartsandcultures.org/Kellen-Trinel. At Trinal Original and at Quantum Theory Pod on Instagram. And of course, you can always find it again on our Old Wall Variety Hour website. Tots Lahain Oikolo, good day everyone. And again, Katsi Yao Yao Kellen for being with us here today. Aho.
That was from a song called Electric Powwow Drum by A Tribe Called Red, which followed a conversation between Indigenous activists Julian Ankeny and Kellen Trinel about land and language in Indian country. The ultimate eradication of gun violence in this country will require a transition from a culture of violence to a culture of peace. So argues global health consultant and writer for the globalists Cesar Shilala, in an article published in Counterpunch June 22nd. Short of wholesale cultural change, however, are many policies that would work to curb gun violence. Bill Resnick examines Shalala's list of actions to reduce gun violence.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole doing a well-read read, reading and commenting on gun violence. It's a piece is titled, Can the United States Curb the Epidemic of Gun Violence? By Cesar Shilala. Shilala is a global health consultant, a contributing editor for The Globalist, a journal out of New York committed to rethinking globalization. He's written learned reports for medical journals and the UN and hundreds of articles in newspapers and magazines. This article comes from Counterpunch, and this is Cesar Shilala. An epidemic is hitting the U.S., and ordinary citizens are unable to stop it. The reason is simple. The laws protect the killers. and those responsible for making the laws have abdicated their responsibility. The gun violence archive reports that mass shootings have increased from 269 in 2014 to 693 in 2021. They do so even when the victims could be their children or grandchildren, engulfed in a wave of violence and death that is increasingly targeting schools. The young men who commit these acts of violence are suffering, sometimes from trauma, including childhood neglect, which can manifest as depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, and attempts. Social isolation, despite a desire to belong to a community of peers or others, and a feeling of powerlessness. Like suicide bombers, they have nothing to lose in those violent acts which are meant to be witnessed. In addition to being motivated by racism and hate, can be understood as manifestations of self-hate and a desire to appropriate power. Most young shooters have been the victims of ACE, adverse childhood experiences. These are the result of situational issues, the main ones being parental abuse, violent community life, problems at school, poverty. While these issues may surface at schools, there are severe limitations on what school personnel can do. Parental consent is always needed for interventions. Self-referral is unusual and unlikely in cases with family problems. Many schools do not have psychological or social work services at all. Local authorities often feel powerless at the lack of federal guidance to curb the universal accessibility of guns. Americans bought almost 20 million guns in 2021, the second busiest year on record. The Small Arms Survey of 2017 estimated there were more guns than people in the U.S. in round figures, 393 million firearms in a country of 326,474,000 inhabitants. Since not every person in the U.S. owns a gun, it means that many people own more than one. President Biden has proposed several common sense measures, including a ban on assault weapons, expansion of background checks, obligatory safe storage of weapons, a red flag law, and a repeal of the liability clause that shelters gun manufacturers from being sued. These are important measures. They should be complemented, however, by enacting federal legislation aimed at stricter enforcement of gun registration, effective control of the manufacture, sale, and import of firearms, and harsher penalties for violating these rules. In addition, severe penalties should be imposed on parents and other adults whose children have access to firearms owned legally and registered or who give them as presents to their children. Don Emanuel Orlando Garcia, a New York psychiatrist, says about these legislators who are willing to pass any meaningful gun control legislation, by defending freedom and life, they get elected, noble aims, but for them, the life of an embryo counts more than the life of a child. And the unrestricted freedom to buy weapons counts more than the freedom to be safe in a park or school. Same people who value the life of a mother less than that of a fertilized egg. The same that legalize state killings and blame the victims of inequality and homelessness justify with their jargon the ongoing massacre of gun violence infecting the country, including increasing numbers of school children. They claim guns do not kill, omitting to say that any person with a gun could become a killer when affected by intense emotions. No need to suffer a mental illness. Again, I'm reading from the op-ed, Can the U.S. Curb the Epidemic of Gun Violence? On the Counterpunch website by Cesar Shalala. Gun violence is also an economic problem, but since lack of employment opportunities increases the risk of gun violence, as Reverend Gregory Boyle, who works on this issue in East Los Angeles, has said, nothing stops a bullet like a job. One Summer Chicago Plus, a jobs program designed to prepare youth from some of the city's most violent neighborhoods, saw a 43% drop in violent crime arrests among its participants. Japan has almost no deaths due to gun violence. Why cannot the U.S., the most powerful country in the world, do the same? Although recent measures to control gun ownership are useful, what is truly needed is an effective ban on all guns and education efforts to change the culture of violence in the country. We need to move from a culture of violence to a culture of peace. Continuous failure to act will lead to spiraling of violence of unforeseen but certainly nefarious consequences for people's lives and for our future as a civilized nation. By claiming that they are pro-life, lawmakers who are unwilling to control gun violence are in effect pro-death. That was Cesar Chavala from the Counterpunch website. I'd like to make a comment. Salal is clearly correct to conclude, although recent measures to control gun owners are useful, what is truly needed is an effective ban on all guns and education efforts to change a culture of violence in this country. We need to move from a culture of violence to a culture of peace. Well, yes, to be sure, but education goes only so far when it collides with the dominant culture. And this society creates lots of mental problems, lots of people in the gray economy where gangs compete for turf, lots of anger, lots of violence. And given the prevalence of guns, we get a lot of murder by gun and suicide by gun. And much of the depression, despair, and anger that generates the violence is people's experiences, the social practices, and the values that legitimate the practices, like experiencing corporal punishment or domestic violence, or learning violence as a mark of masculinity, or being in the lower registers of the U.S. steep pecking order. And we live in a society that's not careful with one another and accepts so much homelessness that desensitizes people. And we lack work, and especially dignified work at decent incomes, that weighs on people. And compared to need, we have very little mental health care of any kind. Anyway, we are going to live with a lot of gun violence, unfortunately. But, of course, there are other societies with a lot of trouble, deeply troubled people, and still have low levels of gun violence. Why is that? Because they carefully control guns. The NRA is right. It's troubled people who kill people. But they would not kill near as many if it were not so easy to get a gun, especially an automatic rifle. This was Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I read from an op-ed by Cesar Chavala and the U.S. epidemic of gun violence in the Counterpunch website.
Setting on the century, and we are armed to the teeth. We're all working together now to make our lives mercifully brief. And school kids keep trying to teach us what guns are all about. Confuse liberty with weaponry and watch your kids act it out.
That was a clip from Ani DiFranco's song entitled To the Teeth. Before that, you heard Bill Resnick's commentary on Cesar Chavala's policy proposals to curb gun violence. The link to Chavala's article is posted on our webpage at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Many of us have been glued to our social media devices watching or listening to the drama of the January 6 hearings in Congress. But what will they actually accomplish? Jen Hawken and Mike Snedeker discussed the hearings and their possible impacts.
The January 6th committee will be televising its seventh episode this week in their series of public hearings on the attack on the Capitol. In the first hearing, the committee showed video footage from a documentary filmmaker embedded with the Proud Boys on January 6th. Footage that helped make the case that this and other right-wing militia groups were involved in leading the mob. The hearing this week is expected to show that Trump enlisted these groups in furthering his aim of staying in power. Well, Mike, as a documentary filmmaker myself, I was particularly interested in the storytelling arc of the hearings, a series of hearings, as well as the role of various protagonists brought onto the stage, mostly Republicans who agreed to testify. So let's start with one of the central storytelling arcs of the hearings. Testimony unfolded to tell the story of the attack on the Capitol as an attempted coup carried out by Trump and his legal advisors. So what's at stake for Trump and his cronies legally and politically? in this case, that January 6th was part of an attempted coup?
Well, I think that is the basic story. And the Republicans made a monumental screw up when they decided not to participate in the January 6th hearings. So we do have a real narrative. We have a story arc. It's been artfully presented. And had they had what was originally proposed, which is equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats, all to be over with by 2021's end, then they would have been able to muck things up. But as it is, we have a growing story. It's getting better and better. They've now got insiders, the sort of young interns, idealistic types that are the heartbeat of both Republicans and Democrats in any large organization. Cassidy Hutchinson's reporting on what she saw was riveting because it comes from the person who was an idealist, someone who looked up to these people and was working precisely because of her admiration. So the tone of deep disappointment that she threw in was very effective.
Yeah, youth seduced and abandoned by the elders. I mean, it's often part of tragedies and other dramas where you have the king surrounded by ushers and pages in the court who attend to his every whim, but often have a kind of power through their intimacy circulating close to power that exposes a certain vulnerability, the Achilles heel of the king. So there's aspect of that drama here with these interns playing an outsized role, often not paid very much. And I think Trump may not have known her name, though probably did recognize her as a pretty young woman. But what do you make of the power of their testimony? Is it that they're kind of innocent and not locked into power? So even though they're Republicans who I think were aspiring themselves to moving up the ranks of the Republican Party.
Well, they were there. See, you and I could not be there. Nobody listening to this show could be there. But because they believed and they were idealistic, they were there, and they were also just like wallpaper. They were so omnipresent, doing, you know, all the coffee carrying, all the document copying, all those kind of routine things that need to be done. They were basically invisible. So they got a very close, intimate look at what was going down.
I think also the point you make, though, about they're projecting the innocence and the idealism of youth, much like Caroline Edwards, a U.S. Capitol Police officer who opened the hearings, also present to comment on the testimony of her being attacked by the mob. And so by her presence and Hutchinson's presence, you accept their point of view. You know, they offer a kind of POV, a point of view on the testimony on the screen, as well as identifying with their sense of being betrayed by their elders. Whereas a lot of the political establishment, the Republicans that were testifying, were not as riveting as these young people.
Yeah, and this will make it possible, I think, to actually criminally prosecute Donald Trump, which has been very hard to do. You know, we talked a long time ago about why the New York prosecutor should prosecute him and could prosecute him, because he has run a criminal enterprise for 30 or 40 years, valuing his buildings at a really high number when he wants a loan, valuing them as trash when he wants to pay taxes on them, stiffing people right and left. There's dozens of crimes that he's committed that, but for some mysterious reason, the prosecution in the Southern District of New York, which is historically maybe the most important prosecutor's office in the country, haven't gone forward. They were about to, or so it seemed, they hired two really skilled prosecutors who were developing the case, but then Cyrus Vance left, and this new guy, Alvin Bragg, has not shown any urgency at all. And those two prosecutors resigned. So that may be foundering.
Well, what about there are a range of potential criminal charges against Trump that have have been introduced in the hearings. I mean, one around fraud that is, I guess, aligned with his business practices, raising money for fraudulent purposes. How does that weigh against some of the other criminal charges? The most, I guess, the most serious is conspiracy and the attempted coup.
Well, the most heartening news for me recently has been the DOJ's actively going after the lawyers, going after James Eastman, John Eastman, Jeffrey Clark, and Giuliani. These are the guys that Trump is going to say, they advised me. I thought I had a chance here. I thought this was a legal angle.
Can you just explain a bit about Eastman's role? Because that emerged in the first hearing. It was central to the fourth hearing. And so it seems to all be both used in Trump's defense that he was advised by this well-respected attorney that there was a legal basis precedent for claiming that Mike Pence could not certify the election and return it to the states. That was Eastman's legal theory that people question, but does that give Trump cover?
Well, and that's why I'm so glad to see them going after these guys, because there is also records where they knew that they were wrong. They knew it was bogus. They knew it was a desperate move that had no legal basis. There's strong evidence that has emerged about a whole fake elector scheme, including testimony from senior Justice Department officials that laid the foundation for charging Eastman and Giuliani and possibly Jeffrey Clark with all kinds of state and federal crimes, including obstruction of an official proceeding, conspiracy to defraud the U.S., false statements in connection with that fake elector scheme, election fraud. There's like cumulative evidence has emerged showing that the president was told explicitly by multiple people that he had lost the election, and that once he exhausted his judicial remedies, which he did pretty quickly, losing 60 cases, his continued pressure campaign to prevent the orderly transfer of power was illegal. Now, what the lawyers did said they recognized that was the case. And yet they came up with this last minute scheme without any basis in other than the most threadbare thread, namely of having Mike Pence being able to do something that no one's ever done before, no one's even talked about doing before, based on an obscure reading of obscure statutes, that he had suddenly the power to completely stop and reframe elections to be decided by a Republican body.
How do you see the testimony and perhaps the position of Liz Cheney as expressive of a struggle and the split within the Republican Party?
Well, Jared Kushner once said that my father-in-law has executed a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. That's exactly right. Now, who did he take it from? He took it from the Bushes and the Cheneys. They formerly were the Republican Party with all the hyper-aggressive foreign policies that they still have, but they had a sense of decor or how to play the game that Trump realized was not popular and that he could bring a different attitude. And so doing, not only was he successful in ripping the party away from these people, but he got a lot of support from people who value him more for his attitude than for any of his positions. Now, of course, they were not pleased in any sense. So this is the classic, divide. It's the only way, in fact, the truth has any chance of emerging is when different factions fight for themselves and in so doing bring down or present the evidence that would undercut the other side.
There's also the dramatic role of the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, the Proud Boys, though, who've regularly appeared in rallies and events here in Oregon to terrorize people. They're They played a starring role in the hearings and expected to this week. How much weight would you give to that case that Trump was directly or indirectly involved in communicating and coordinating on some fashion the attack on the Capitol with these militia groups?
Well, he told them to stand back and stand by. There was no secret. That's the banana republic aspect of all this, is that he had hoped to have an assault that would cause chaos and that he would then step in to calm things down and be, and of course the Proud Boys were a critical part of that. They were the ones who got there first, who had tools to cut locks. They were an indispensable part of the attack on the Capitol building.
Okay, well, we'll continue to follow this as it unfolds and try to understand some of the tensions, conflicts, and crises here for the Republican Party and the right as we build an alternative vision through the left.
And let's close with a kudos to Kevin McCarthy for having allowed the Democrats to set up this panel with only one or two very embittered and very skillful and determined Republicans in order to create what, as you say, has been a marvelously good job at storytelling, a narrative arc, and we're here on the edge of another cliffhanging precipice with yet another exciting day of testimony due coming up on July 12th, Tuesday.
Yeah, it reminds me of Jared Kushner, whose testimony was included several times, where he says, well, I just thought these guys were whining a lot. Well, they are just whining now about this committee. Well, too bad. Toughen up. Tough it out. Okay, thanks, Mike. We'll continue to cover this.
Right on. Take care.
This is treason. This is treason. This is insurrection. This is rebellion. Period.
Unrehearsed Musical presents.
To be played at high volume.
7-4-7. Odd smoke is in the building. They are known to be very destructive. They might have
C4. Now everybody take a look. Can you see what's going on? This riot's on Capitol Hill. The POTUS has them tripping. It's mind over matter. We're in the game of life. Tear gas, fire, put your gas mask on. Run for the hills or take your stance. Everybody has their opinion. Votes counted up, are they real? They could be fake, but how? How do we know we're the public? We're never told nothing. I'ma run through the streets. I got a flag in the heads, UMG, and we own it. Better drop another classic. I'ma tell y'all the truth. There's a fight or no drop. I don't know who's gonna win. You better be ready, cause I'm coming with the smoke.
You just heard Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker about the significance of the Congressional January 6 hearings, followed by a clip from a song called Capitol Hill by Tucson musicians and rappers Daniel Grijalva and Luis Vasquez. They wrote the song in protest of the attempted coup of January 6, 2021. The U.S. Marine Corps should take climate change seriously, not only because the U.S. military alone emits more greenhouse gases than three-quarters of the nations in the world, but also as the planet fries and becomes less hospitable to human habitation, conflicts over land and water and survival are going to increase exponentially. Military consultant and insider Elizabeth G. Bolton recently took the U.S. Marine Corps to task for their approach to climate change in a quite astonishing and comprehensive report. Here's Bill Resnick to walk us through what she wrote.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here to introduce you to an astounding study, but not because of its message. Climate scientists the world over have been saying it for years, warning us that if the major countries on planet Earth continue on their current course, that is dumping in the atmosphere greenhouse gases, mostly from burning fossil fuels, but it's also agriculture and manufacturing, if they keep doing it, that would lead in a fairly short time to the extinction of most mammals, including Homo sapiens. What's different about this report is that it names the culprit. the military and corporate apparatuses, and it makes recommendations for action with a distinctive left cast. What's also different, indeed astounding, about this warning is where it came from. Where? From the United States Marine Corps, those fine fellows who have been bringing order around the world from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. It was published by the official Marine Corps Press, yes, they have a publishing unit, as a book that would never have seen the light of day unless the top brass of the Marine Corps thought its message was well worth bringing to public attention and the political elite. I'll be introducing the study, reading excerpts from it. It was written by Elizabeth Bolton, who served as a planner for the Australian Army, was elevated to chief researcher, and became alarmed by the climate threat. She now works for the organization Destination Safe Earth. First, she discusses the magnitude of the threat as follows. The hyper-threat impact is an unprecedented combination of rapid global warming and the unraveling of Earth's ecological systems. Of heightened concern, the study warns that the hyper-threat's most dangerous course of action is provoking cascading tipping elements, thereby accelerating a transition to what she calls hothouse Earth, a state uninhabitable for most species. In the report, failure to address the danger within a 2022-25 timeline with proactive, real-time, actual policies, that's explained in war terms. The hyper-threat has war-like destructive capabilities that make it hard to recognize the enormity of its destructive impacts or who is responsible for its hostile actions. This is a phenomenon that humanity has never encountered before. Next, she identifies the culprits, the folks responsible for global warming, who is responsible and why they began and continue. It demonstrates that activities of military intelligence agencies are, I quote, accelerating the likelihood of triggering a worst-case hothouse Earth scenario. Here's me speaking. Who would have thought it was published by the Marine Corps and aimed at the political establishment? She continues, by seeking to protect the existing fossil fuel system, humanity's security agencies are in effect working for the enemy. Yet that is not intentional behavior. Rather, it's the effect of national security institutions' entanglement within the status quo. It's a normal operational behavior. Moreover, the study broadens the indictment in contending that various agencies of government have become the biggest danger to planetary security, in effect working to accelerate the hyper-threat of climate environmental change. And it does not spare the corporation. For example, she reports that the oil and gas companies are projected to spend a staggering $1.5 trillion by 2040 in exploring and developing fossil fuel properties. She further clarifies how this came to pass. After the Second World War, a military strategy involved securing resources and protecting supply chains, all considered crucial to post-war rebuilding and prosperity. But it's now clear that this very system, which military and security strategies are designed to support, is the primary driver of global insecurity. That primary driver is, of course, international capitalism. She goes on in a twisted manner. The very resources regarded as good and critical for functioning the global system now threaten all forms of planetary life. By applying economic, diplomatic, military, and other tools of force and power to participate in the race for what's left of Earth's resources, humanity is unwittingly aiding the hyper-threat. Well, I'm not sure it's humanity, but you get the point. Again, astonishingly, this study was published by the U.S. Marine Corps Press and never would have been approved for publication if Marine top brass did not think that Bolton's views were worthy of being considered in the national security conversation.
From the halls of we
Resnick here on KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, and live stream 24/7, 365 to the universe. Introduce Elizabeth Bolton's study, Plan E, a grand strategy for the 21st century of entangled security and hyper threats. That's published by both the Journal of Advanced Military Studies and the U.S. Marine Corps Press. The study also makes recommendations, referring to the $1.5 trillion spent by the oil and gas industry, exploring and developing properties. She asked, what if it was spent on renewables and mitigation measures? For example, solar power panel and wind turbine installations, retrofitting buildings to maximum energy efficiency, or sustainable public transportation, or enhancing carbon sinks. Note carbon sinks to enhance our forests, peat bogs, regenerative agriculture, anything that stores carbon dioxide. Bolton also recommends that implementation of the program need be civilian-led and involves civilian mobilization. Military forces would be partially reconfigured as part of the strategic realignment and will form a portion of larger hyper-response forces. That is, large parts of the military will become a civilian conservation corps, and other parts will contribute to the construction of solar panels and wind turbines, getting them in operation as quickly as possible. And the study makes many recommendations for international agreements. One idea is establishment of a global climate emergency peace treaty from 2022 to 2030 to allow nations to focus on the emergency hyper-response. Another idea is to use international diplomacy to create a new natural rules-based governing architecture for the world based on ecological survival and safe earth requirements. For this, we need to reimagine the role of great powers in the world, realigning geopolitical security with the overarching aim of containing the hyper threat. She explores how ecological thinking can be used to reinvent traditional political institutions. Multilateralism should become eco-multilateralism to facilitate cooperation on caring for ecosystems and disaster response. She suggests Earth citizenship could allow nations to mobilize the world's 18 million work-ready, forcibly displaced people in hyper-response work. One review of the study concludes that the Bolton thesis is an extraordinarily important statement of facts about the invisibility and difficulty of identifying risks. In point of fact, their normal operating behavior is inbred into the economic fabric of late-stage capitalism, which, according to the Bolton thesis, can be detoured and maybe even defeated, but only by well-directed, powerful, universal action commencing this decade. But the window for achievement is narrow. My sense is that the Bolton Report, again published by the U.S. Marine Corps, provides a terrific summary of the left's program, taking most of the elements of Bernie Sanders' Green New Deal in many ways more radical. That's probably not intentional. What's not intentional is that it's the left program. It's becoming clear to many scientists, engineers, and research organizations that do not identify as left that the corporate program, relying on unproven and potentially dangerous technologies, would be catastrophic, and the elements of the left program might make for human survival. This study by Elizabeth Bolton called for a complete transformation of our economy and the mission and structure of the militaries of the world. And it indicts capitalism, corporate business as usual, as the enemy, taking us on a death march. Pretty remarkable. But will it be read and debated and then acted upon? Very likely not in the immediate future, not in depth and intensity that it should be. In the immediate future, it's going to be likely be dismissed as alarmist, with our corporate friends continuing to assure us that we have everything in hand to halt climate change. We are operating in a deliberate, rational, business-like way, not panicking, to be sure, and wasting valuable time and resources. But other voices will also be heard, and the left program emphasizing local build-out of renewable sun and wind energy will be visible on the ground in near every city. My prediction One day soon, the people will awake, demand a mobilization to fully implement the left program. All of us must work for that day. Hopefully, it's not too late. This was Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Bill Resnick speaking about a recent high-level critique of the Marines' climate change strategy. Links to Bolton's article can be found on our webpage at kboo.fm. That does it for our show today. I'd like to thank Moles Julian Ankeny, Bill Resnick, Jan Hocken, and Mike Snedeker for their contributions, and also Denise Morris and Desiree Helligers for their editing assistance. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. A big shout out to the staff at KBOO, always there behind the scenes to keep KBOO on the air. Next Monday morning, tune in at 9 a.m. for a rebroadcast of a segment from Against the Grain about our post-capitalist future. I'd like to leave you today with original music produced by Indigenous youth of the Enkla Pamak Nation in British Columbia. The song is entitled, "The Language is the Land." Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay active.
Somebody to see me, knowing that I'll never make it too easy, that's fine by me. I'll stay rooted to my feet. I'll stay rooted to my feet.